from Mark's Gospel, chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. And that can be found in the Bibles on page 1006. So Mark's Gospel, chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along, just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat, so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who's this? Even the wind and waves obey him."
While there's still hope, you can keep going. If you're losing 1-0 with 10 minutes to go, there's still hope. You can keep going. Losing 5-0 with 10 minutes to go, there's no real hope. It's hard to muster up the energy to keep playing. Without hope, very hard to keep going. And that's why we always look for something upon which to pin our hopes. What is it for you? What's the thing where you say, "Today's not that great, today's not brilliant, but I can keep going because I'm pinning my hope on..." What is it for you? What are you pinning your hopes on? "I can keep working for my A-levels because I pinned my hopes on going to university, and when I get to university, it'll be great. That's going to make it all worthwhile." Or, "I can keep practicing the saxophone even though it's a slog, because I'm hoping I will make it as a musician, strike a record deal, and that's what keeps me going." Or, "Today's not that good actually, but I hope to get married someday and have children, and it's the prospect of that that keeps me going through today." Or you say, "Well, I hope to stay healthy, and you know, as long as I've got my health, I can keep going. Maybe it's just a holiday. I can keep going today because actually I'm hoping to have a holiday in a few weeks' time, and that would be such a break." And the question is, are the things that we pin our hopes on big enough? Well, what if something else comes along and just blows them over? Well, what if it rains on your holiday? What if I fail all my A-levels? What if the whole music career comes to nothing? What if I can't find anyone to marry? What if it turns out I can't have children? What if the test results from the hospital are not good? At the time of Jesus, the people of Israel had pinned their hopes on the Messiah. As we saw last week, the story of the people of Israel starts with Genesis. Their God was the God who made the whole world, and he was in charge of the whole world. Only around the time of Jesus, it didn't look like it. But more like the Romans were in charge, pushing them around. And so their question was a bit like our question. Their question was, if God is in charge, how come the news is mostly bad? Where is he? Well, back in the Old Testament, God had promised that one day he would send his Messiah. And Messiah means God's king. God was going to send his king to deal with all that's gone wrong in this world and put things right. He was going to give his people a future to look forward to. And that's why they pinned their hopes on him. And do you remember from last week how Mark starts his gospel saying, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Gospel means good news. Christ means Messiah, God's King. So he's saying, I've got good news, everyone. You know the Messiah we've been waiting for? He's come. Jesus of Nazareth is God's King. He's the one who's come to give us a future to look forward to. And one of the great themes of Mark's Gospel is he wants to make it clear that Jesus has not just come to, to give hope to the Jewish people, he wants us all to pin our hopes on Jesus. Whoever we are, wherever we're from, he wants us to see that Jesus has come to give you a future to look forward to. And he spends 16 chapters showing us why. And today we're going to look at just four of the miracles Jesus performs. And the point about Jesus' miracles is they were not party tricks to kind of wow people, draw a crowd. He did them to show everyone who he was and why he had come, to show them that he was God's king. And he did have power and authority to give them a future to look forward to. But you see, it might be that I've lost you already. You're asking me to pin my hopes on a story about a man who did miracles. You're next going to be asking me to wish upon a falling star, or look out for black cats and four-leaf clovers. I mean, this is just desperate, superstitious nonsense, isn't it? This is whistling in the dark. Well, we mustn't treat the people of the first century as though they were fools who fell for any old thing that they were told. Mark knew the laws of nature. He knew that people don't normally walk on water. He knew it was not normal for someone to be able to feed 5,000 people with a small boy's packed lunch. But that is his point. The things Jesus did were not normal. They were extraordinary. They broke the laws of nature. And that's because Jesus was not normal. He was extraordinary. He was bigger than the laws of nature. Let's zoom in on some of the details. First episode. We look at these four episodes, starting at chapter 4, verse 35. The first episode shows us that Jesus is bigger than the sea. Jesus is bigger than the sea. This is chapter 4, verses 35 to 41. They're crossing a lake in this boat, and a storm blows up. We need to remember that Galilee is not the kind of boating lake that we sometimes think of it as. It's nearly 15 miles long, about 8 miles wide, and because it's 700 feet below sea level, and it's surrounded by hills, what would happen is cold air kind of rushes down the hills, collides with the warm air over the lake, and you get these huge storms. And this was one of them. Look at verse 37. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Imagine the disciples struggling to lower the sails, as canvas flapping around, as wind blowing the tops off the waves into their faces, and the open boat is filling up, it's nearly swamped. And these men, they were professional fishermen. They've sailed through about a million storms like this. And so they try to turn the boat into the wind, they try everything they know, they're bailing out as fast as they can, but this is a huge storm, and in the teeth of it, they're powerless. Nothing they can do. So verse 38, Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. And the disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown? Wake up, Jesus. Teacher, don't you even care? What good is your teaching now? How can you sleep through this? You could at least grab a jar and, you know, get bathing with the rest of us, but it's too late now. We're going to drown. So much for your teaching." They've lost all hope. Long as you like. Jesus gets up, makes his way to the front of the boat, and we read verse 39. He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. And he turns to them, verse 40, he said to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" So you'd be saying, why are you afraid of the storm? Don't you see who I am? And you'd think they might be relieved, but as the penny drops, they begin to be terrified. See verse 41, they were terrified. But literally, they feared with an even greater fear. The sea was terrifying of abyss. This is even more terrifying. Because they have got a man in their boat who is bigger than the sea. And that's why they ask, "Who is this? Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." And you see, what's happened is what Jesus has done has just run all kinds of Old Testament bells. when the people of Israel had been chased by the Egyptians, and they came up against the sea, and when it looked like there was no hope, because the Egyptians were closing them down, who was it who had parted the sea to save them? The Lord their God. They knew the account off by heart. They knew the Psalms off by heart. They knew things like Psalm 89. They're talking about the Lord their God. You rule over the surging sea, and when its waves mount up, you still them. So it's in their blood. The only person who could control the sea was the Lord their God, who made the sea. So who is this man who can control the sea? Teacher, they called him. They thought the man asleep in their boat was just another religious teacher. Guess that's kind of what we think. You know, he's just a religious teacher. If you've got religious questions, if that's your sort of thing, then he might be for you. But it's hard to see how he could be relevant to the rest of us. In the teeth of the storms that batter us, it seems kind of unlikely that a teacher would be the sort of person who could help. Have you seen the footage on the news? You know, when there were storms crashing against the coastline. Do you remember the power of the tsunami? Turns out Jesus is not just another religious teacher. Turns out he's bigger than the sea. It's terrifying. It is terrifying. And the very thing that makes him terrifying is the very thing that means he's the one who could bring hope. Because just a few minutes before, they had no hope. Now, they have a future. They're looking forward to going ashore, being reunited with family and friends, and sitting by the fire and warming themselves. And why do they have a future? Because Jesus was bigger than the sea. Climate scientists are telling us, aren't they, that we're beyond the tipping point. The seas are rising. There's nothing we can do to hold them back. What hope for the future of this planet? Here is a man who's bigger than the sea. It means Jesus is not just for people who want a bit of religious teaching. Here is someone who holds the future of this planet in his hands. It means whoever we are, if we're on this planet, he is our own man. First thing, Jesus is bigger than the sea. Second thing, Jesus is bigger than evil. This is crossing to chapter 5. Let's have a look at it together. Next day they cross the lake, and we read verse 2. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tomb to meet him, and this man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. The man is in the grip of some kind of evil spirit, and it seems like there is nothing anyone can do for him. This is a hopeless case. Verse 5, night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. It's hopeless and destructive. And again, just before we look at this, we mustn't be intellectually imperialistic. Because we're very quick to dismiss this whole idea of evil spirits. They were primitive people, they didn't really know much. But if we were reading this in Africa, or South America, or Asia, or Eastern Europe, or pretty much anywhere in the world today, or even in England just a couple of hundred years ago, we wouldn't be batting an eyelid. Actually, you just have to go down to the borders and look at the size of the occult section to see there are plenty of people in Bristol today who wouldn't be batting an eyelid at an account like this. We may not have encountered evil in precisely this sort of form, but we're only too aware of the grip evil does have on our world. Last week, I sat down with a friend to watch the telecom news. It went like this. There was footage of the British man who had been taken hostage in Iraq. There were details of the sentence of a serial killer. There was news of a suspected child abuse in a home in New Jersey. And there was an interview with a father whose daughter had been murdered many years ago, but no one had been convicted, and all he wanted was closure. He sat there, he was a broken man, he just wanted closure to this thing. I was watching with a friend, and we just sat there in silence. We just had this sense of being overwhelmed by this little snapshot of our world. And at the end of it, anybody saw this, at the end of it, there was a story of a parrot who'd be fitted with an artificial leg. And it was a desperate attempt to say, hey, the world's not so bad because you've got a parrot that's been fitted with an artificial leg. This parrot's got a new lease of life. Brilliant! But I don't think anyone was fooled for a moment. Not as though that was an especially bad day. It just keeps on coming. Nothing anyone seems to be able to do about it. Legislate all we like, but nobody seems to be able to restrain the evil in our world. And the point is, nobody could restrain this man. But Jesus comes along, and the evil spirits are terrified of him. Do you see verse 7? Look down at verse 7. This is the spirit in this guy saying, he shouted at the top of his voice, what do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me. Jesus said to him, come out of this man, you evil spirit. Down to verse 11. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them. He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. And the herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Of course, post Beatrix Potter, we worry about the poor pigs. For Jesus, this man, this one man, was way more precious to him than this very pigs. And then all the commotion brings the whole village out to see what's happened. And so verse 15, when they came to Jesus, they saw the man who'd been possessed by this legion of demons sitting there, dressed, and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Did they see him restored? Did they see him set free? And you think they'd be pleased, and you think they'd be relieved, but no, they are afraid. They had seen the extraordinary power of evil as it gripped this man, and they were afraid of that. He broke chains, and now, like the disciples back in the boat, standing before Jesus, they are even more afraid. Here was a man bigger than evil. And so they don't particularly invite him in for a cup of tea, for a kind of nice chat about spirituality. They say, go away. They can't cope. The fact that he's bigger than evil is what makes him terrifying. But again, it's the fact that he's bigger than evil is why he brings hope. He's given this man a whole new future. He set him free. Obviously, I can't see in people's hearts, but perhaps in your own life, you're very aware of being in the grip of something. Something that you have to call evil in a way. Something you can't shake. And you keep doing something you wish you didn't do. You keep saying things you wish you hadn't said. You keep hurting the people you most love. And time and again you vow, that's never going to happen again. That is the last time that it keeps on happening. And you've got to the point where you've lost all hope. Although they've only been able to change. You see, here's the one. Here's the one who can give you a future. Here's the one who can set you free. Because however big the evil we're in the grip of, he's bigger. He's bigger than sin. He's bigger than evil. And then working through the chapter, we see he's bigger than sickness and death. Look at verse 22. Then one of the synagogue, they cross back over the lake again. Jesus is surrounded by crowds of people. And we read verse 22, one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there, and seeing Jesus, fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him. My daughter is dying. Please come, put your hands on her so she'd be healed and live. He's one of the synagogue rulers, Jairus. He's a man of great power, great influence. But not on this day. Because on this day, his daughter is dying. And he's so used to sorting out other people's problems, and he would give anything to be able to sort out this problem, to save his daughter. But all his influence and all his power, they count for nothing. There's nothing he can do. It's often when your children are ill. When you have to hand them over to a doctor. Those are the moments when you feel so helpless. Because up till then, you kind of felt you were in charge of your children. You were keeping them safe. We'd given them a good home. We'd looked after them. We're providing for them. But, now, Now, this is bigger than me, and we know how to deal with it. But what are your hopes pinned on in that moment? Jairus has heard about Jesus. He's heard of his power to heal and restore. And so this big man falls at the feet of this carpenter from Lazarus and says, "Jesus, you're my only hope." And Jesus goes with him. And the hopes were raised at Jairus. But then on the way, Jesus interrupted. Verse 24, Jesus went with him, and a large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who'd been subject to bleeding for 12 years, and she'd suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and spent all she had. Yet, instead of getting better, she grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed." And immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was free from the suffering. This woman had been suffering some kind of menstrual bleeding. It would have been the kind of condition that meant she may not have been able to get married or have children. And while there were doctors to try, well, there was still hope. But she's got to the stage where she's tried everyone, and she's spent all her money, and it's not got better, it's got worse. And which means she's lost all the hope of the life she once dreamed of. But like Jairus, she's heard of the power that Jesus has to heal and restore. And so like Jairus, she sees that Jesus is her only hope. Sure enough, he heals her. Verse 34, he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." So what's happened? Jesus has given her a future. You ask anyone who's had to endure chronic illness, and they will tell you how wearisome it is. You can't see beyond it. It affects your whole sense of who you are. And worst of all, it takes away all the dreams you once had. All the things you were going to do that you now can't. Because you never imagined you'd spend your days stuck at home like this. And your sickness feels like the biggest thing in your life. But you see, here is one. Who is bigger than sickness? He's bigger even than death. Look at verse 35. While Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, and said, "Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore?" I've always felt that these people could do with a course on kind of pastoral skills. See, particularly bluntly breaking the news. But however the news was broken, it was always going to be devastating, wasn't it? Imagine the roller coaster Jarvis was on. 1 minute, hopes raised, and now they're dashed. Because now it's over. There's nothing anyone can do now. Can't rewind death. Jesus says, verse 36, "Don't be afraid. Just believe. Don't be afraid." Remember back in the boat, Jesus asked his disciples, "Why are you afraid? Are you afraid of the storm?" "I'm bigger than the storm." "Jairus, are you afraid of death?" "Don't be afraid of death. You're with me. I'm bigger than death." We get back to Jairus' house. We read verse 38. "When they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly, and he went in. And he said to them, 'Why all this commotion and wailing? The child's not dead, but asleep.' But they laughed at him." They laughed at him. They said, "Look, we're not fools. What do you think? We know a dead girl when we see one." Jesus is not suggesting she has just slipped into a coma. What he's saying is, yes, to you she's dead. To you she's out of reach. For you, death is the end. And once death has got hold of her, there is nothing you can do to get her back. Oh, but to me, just like she's asleep. I have power to wake her up. I have power to reach into death and then bring her back. And so verse 41, he took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means little girl, "and say to you, get up." And immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was about 12 years old. And at this, they were completely astonished. They were astonished. They know that this is not normal. Here is a man who is bigger than death. And you see, for us, death leaves things unresolved, unsaid, dreams unrealized. Everything is broken by death. And there's nothing we can do to put the pieces back together again, because it's too late. And there's so much more we wanted to say, but death has the final word. But here is man, bigger than death. It's something I got in a newsletter. A Christian leader writes a newsletter. It came through the door this week, and he said this. During the Christmas week, my 11-year-old nephew was told by a hospital consultant that he was going to die. A scan had just revealed the sudden and aggressive spread of multiple brain and spine tumours. David, my sister's son, looked into the doctor's eyes and said, "I'm not afraid of dying. I have a friend called Jesus who will take me to be with him forever." The doctor smiled warmly and said, "David, I'm so glad you know Jesus, because he's my friend and my saviour too." He's a small boy. And that consultant oncologist both knew that death did not have the last word on David's life. But Jesus was bigger than death. So even in the face of a diagnosis like that, David had hope. He had a future to look forward to. He's bigger than the sea. He's bigger than evil. He's bigger than sickness and death. So from what Mark is showing us, do you see who Jesus is? Very striking, isn't it? The people who encounter Jesus in the Gospels like this, they never walked away thinking Jesus was just a good man and some nice things to say about forgiving your enemies. You know, lovely for people who are into that sort of thing, but not my bag. They were terrified by him. They were completely astonished by him. And it struck me during the week that if I had never been terrified by Jesus, then I'd been completely astonished. Probably never really seen who he is. Because over the years we've domesticated him, we've made him small. But if the Queen walked in right now, I take it we'd all stand up, wouldn't we? Or if someone like Nelson Mandela walked in right now, we'd stand up, we'd probably cheer. But if Jesus, this Jesus of the Gospels walked in, I take it we'd fall on our faces, wouldn't we? If he walked in. And the disciples' question is the right one to ask. Who is this man who's bigger than the sea, who's bigger than evil, who's bigger than sickness, who's bigger than death? Who is he? And Mark wants us to see that he is in fact the king God had promised. And the king God had promised was not just going to be king of the Jews, he was going to be king with power and authority over the whole universe, over seas and evil and sickness and death and over my life and over your life. If he's just a teacher from 2,000 years ago, then he's very easy to ignore Jesus. But if he's God's king of the world, if the future of this planet, if my future, if your future is in his hands, I can't afford to ignore him. In Narnia, do you remember when Mr. Beaver tells the children about Aslan, about the fact that he's a lion, and they're not at all sure they want to meet him? Is he safe? Asks Lucy. Safe? Says Mr. Beaver. Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. And that's Mark's message to us. Jesus is not safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. And look at what he has come to do with all his power. He's come to put this broken world back together again. Is there any hope for this world? Yes. Because God has not abandoned us to storms and evil and sickness and death. He sent his king to restore this world how it was meant to be. So do you see why he is the one to pin our hopes on? You say, hold on, hold on, hold on. I'm not pinning my hopes on Jesus. Look at the world. Don't you read the news? There are still storms. There's still evil. There's still sickness. There's still death. He hasn't restored anything. He's a fraud. Gospels, Jesus is showing us who he is. He's showing us what he has come to do. But the point is, he's started, but he hasn't yet finished. restore all things. One day there'll be no more storms or evil or sickness or death. But see, what he's doing now is he's giving us a chance to recognize who he is. So that when he finally comes to make all things new, we will be ready for him and we will be part of his eternal kingdom. Maybe you've lost all hope. You feel you have no future particularly to look forward to. Jesus says, do you see who I am? Do you see who I come to you? I come to give you a future to look forward to. A world made new. All the broken pieces put back together. You say, yeah, what is the use of all this talk about, you know, one day in the future? I want it to be different today. But when there is hope for tomorrow, today is very different. Hope for tomorrow means I can keep going today. The prospect of holidays means I can keep going through the exams. If it was endless exams, I'd grind along. Maybe you're someone and you have put your faith in Jesus. You're finding it really hard, trusting him. You're being really battered by storms and evil, sickness and death. And you're wondering if you've pinned your hopes on the right man. Your mark is showing us. He's showing us that if we have pinned our hopes on Jesus, we have got the right man. Because everything else we pin our hopes on will be too small. It won't live. It will get blown away by storms and evil and sickness and in the end, death. Everything else will be blown over. But here is one, bigger than storms and evil and sickness and death. And we may well feel the lash of storms and evil and sickness and death for a time. But think of the people whom Jesus encountered. They were in a storm. They were gripped by evil. They did suffer sickness and death. But the point was, none of those things were the end of the story. Jesus was bigger than each of those things. The final word on their lives was his word. And that's what Mark was saying to us this afternoon. Everything else in our lives will be blown away. Will, in the end. But he is bigger than storms, evil, and sickness, and death. And no power in all the world can blow him away. So if we have put our lives in his hands, then in his hands we could not be safer. Nothing can blow us out of his grip. He won't let us go. He'll get us through today, through tomorrow, and on into a world made new. And that's why as we go out into a bleak world, if we have Christ, we have him. Let's pray. Forgive us for when we have made you small and domesticated. Pray that you'd open our eyes again to see how big you are. And we pray especially in the moments when it is hard to trust you, that you would show us that there is no one bigger, nothing more powerful. In your hands is the one place where we're safe, the one place that gives us hope. So are there questions from the floor that anyone would like to ask? Or any comments anyone would like to make?
This is probably a question that you asked for the family medical team, but we were wondering why is there a pause in lacking a clear conducive idea in terms of being ready to be back in the removal of the suffering, and in terms of the only time that Jesus prayed and opposed to all that kind of suffering. Why are we doing that?
Did everyone hear the question? The question I'm trying to pitch is why there is a pause? Because in the Gospels, Jesus restoring people to how they're meant to be, healing sicknesses, bigger than death, and so on. Why the pause until he comes again and completes the work? Is that the question? Obviously, in one sense, we don't know the answer because we don't know the mind of God. But the way the Bible talks about it is rather than going, well, God's taking his time, why doesn't he hurry up? Rather than being impatient, the Bible again and again says, actually, be glad, because it's giving you a chance to respond and be ready for when he comes. Because when he comes to deal with all that is wrong and put things right, put it around the other way, making all things right means dealing with all that's wrong. So there's something to look forward to about when he comes to put things right. Hooray, he's going to put things right. There's also something very sobering, which is he's going to deal with all that's wrong. And as it stands, we're going to think about this more next week, but we are all caught up in what is wrong. So actually there I say, come, you know, why doesn't Jesus come tomorrow to deal with all that's wrong in this world? But if he was going to come tomorrow, he'd have to deal with me, because I'm part of what's wrong. So I'm very glad at this chance to be restored to him and be ready for that last day. I think that's a hard question, but something that I have a chance. Good question. Have you got another question? Austin, you've got cheeky lying around. That's a question.
No,
question at the back there, sir, yeah.
One thing's always puzzled me. In chapter 5, verse 43, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this. Why did he do that?
Yeah. Thank you. Did you hear the question? Why does Jesus give strict orders not for them not to tell anyone? Because just before, with the man who was kind of demon-possessed, he let him tell people. Yeah. So what's Jesus do? In the area where the guy was in the grip of the evil spirit, it seems that that is not a Jewish area, because the very fact they had pigs means it probably isn't a Jewish area. So Jesus was saying, you tell everyone about me. Okay, tell everyone there is someone around who is bigger than evil. When you've got a Jewish area, there are lots of different expectations about what the Messiah would do. I mean, we know that some people came to Jesus on one occasion and said, will you be our king and we'll take on the Romans together? And Jesus said, no, you haven't understood the sort of king I am. So there is a kind of a caution that particularly comes out in Mark's Gospel, saying, don't just go on about this, because the crowd think, great, he's a king, we can take over the Romans, he can do miracles, brilliant. Whereas Jesus needs to make sure they understand what his agenda really is. His agenda isn't just political, you know, regime change, it isn't just keeping out the Romans. And there are times in Mark's Gospel where, because people do tell their friends about what's happened, so many crowds come that actually Jesus' ministry is scuppered. Because they're like us. They just want to see a good show. But there's a kind of issue of wisdom in the way that Jesus is showing. What's the time? There is normally a clock about. There isn't a clock about. One last question or comment or friend here. Yeah.
You're saying like trust in Jesus in the face of death. He gives us hope in the face of death. But that seems to, I don't know, maybe kind of just appeal to our fear of death. Like, it doesn't necessarily make it true, just because we are afraid of death, and you say, oh, trust in Jesus in the face of death, it doesn't necessarily say, I don't know, it seems a bit just kind of appealing to our emotions a bit, maybe.
Do you ever hear the question, good question, which is, if we're saying trust Jesus in the fear in the face of death, is that a kind of just appealing to our emotions, as in, because we're afraid of death, give us a kind of an answer that is, works on a kind of emotionally satisfying level, but doesn't seem to have any basis. Is that the question? In a way, the answer is to come back in a few weeks' time when we look at the resurrection. Because I know that's not a very good answer today, but But that's to say, the bottom line is, why do we think Jesus is able to bring in a new world? And the Bible's ultimate answer is because he was raised from the dead as the kind of first signs of the rewinding of things, and the putting back together of a broken world. So these are the kind of miracles he does to show that he's got power to restore. But the bottom line miracle is the resurrection, that he's raised from the dead, to show that he is the conqueror of death, and he's beginning a new creation. So in a way, the foundation of that is to ask, if I take Jesus seriously about death, if I look into the resurrection, the way that he was raised from the dead. So yeah, we are afraid of death. We're unashamed about that. But are we just whistling in the dark and say, oh, Jesus is the answer to death? And the New Testament would say, if Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead, our faith is in vain. If Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead, go home. We're wasting our time. Because he's been raised from the dead, that's the foundation, kind of historical foundation, for the faith we have.